There are few things more exasperating than an underperforming sports team. When a team is supposed to be winning but continues to lose, and in the most self-destructive ways imaginable, can drive a fan crazy. There's nothing worse. Well, that's not true. What's even worse is when the losing team talks and acts like they are actually winning. Of course, everyone on the team is playing his best, and they're all doing all that they can. It's just that they're experiencing a long succession of remarkably bad luck. Never mind the record. The record does not reflect the true character or heart of the team. Such are the sentiments that accompany a losing team that thinks they are a winning team. They aren't losers, actually. They just look like it. For fans, such thinking sounds like empty excuses. A losing team is bad enough. A delusional losing team is even worse. And of course, delusional losers are not only found in sports. They show up all over the place. It's the guy at work who never gets a promotion or a bonus, but considers himself an invaluable asset to the company. It's the politician in the minority camp who has no clout and no leverage, but who speaks with the bravado of someone who is in charge. It's the lobbyist for the group with no economic capital, a tiny voter base, and unpopular ideas about legislation who carries on like a winner while everyone else knows him as an insignificant loser. Our world is built on the premise of winners and losers. Whether it is in the arena of sports, politics, economics, manufacturing, business, warfare, romance, or even religion, there are winners and there are losers. For a long, long time, Christians like us enjoyed being counted among the winners. No doubt there were some ups and downs, and Christians have had some rough moments, but ever since Constantine threw in the towel and decided it was wiser to join the Christians than to fight them, Christianity has been enjoying a nice winning streak. Until just lately, that is. The 20th century was hard on the church, at least in the Western world. Serious Christians are no longer counted among those with exemplary character and with important ideas and thoughts simply by virtue of their Christian commitment. In fact, Christians in our country are now facing the uncomfortable reality that not only are they no longer lauded and praised for their faith, they may actually be scorned and vilified. Christians intent on living and preaching the full counsel of God are often seen as obscurantists and obstructionists. Portrayed as judgmental and intolerant, they are dismissed as out of touch, archaic, reactionary, largely irrelevant. And it's not just the debatable or marginal parts of Christian teaching that cause the trouble. You don't have to insist on a young earth to be rejected. Simply assert that Jesus is the only way of salvation, and you've earned the title of hate monger. And it's not just the intellectual or cultural elites who hold such negative attitudes toward believers. It is the dominant view among great swaths of ordinary Americans. In our country today, the position that is winning is that of non-Christians, who are ready to affirm multiple avenues of truth and who cherish individual identity, integrity, and expression as the highest and most sacred ideal. Divine absolutes, eternally true and springing from God's will, are rejected as passé. Today, unbelievers are calling the shots. They are the winners. At least, that's how it looks. By and large, the church in America has not handled her recent demotion and marginalization very well. The reactions vary, of course, but some common themes can be detected. There are the militant and combative believers who loudly declare that they are not going to go down without a fight. They're going to take on the enemy, and they're going to battle with every weapon at their disposal, and even with some weapons co-opted from the other side. Others with a meeker temperament quietly mourn the loss of status and influence and lament the decay of society around them, but mostly feel helpless and grief-stricken. They hope that somehow their personal purity and their fortitude may yet make a difference. Others can't abide their marginalization, and so they look for new ways to fit in and remain relevant, even if it means paying the price of abandoning some parts of Christian doctrine and confession. Eager to be winners again, they embrace the positions of the ones who have defeated them. And there are the new losers who simply refuse to accept the reality and look increasingly like deluded losers. So are we? Are we deluded losers? Are we people who are on the outs and yet who refuse to believe it? A team with a losing record that it will not admit or acknowledge? Have we come up short in the culture wars and yet choose not to face the hard reality of our bitter loss? Are we losers who insist on acting like winners? And perhaps even more to the point, are we actually the losers that the world around us seems to think we are? Now, I know we're supposed to be theologians of the cross and all that, but it's still a tough idea to swallow, isn't it? And it's not just hard to take from a pride or a self-esteem standpoint. There are doctrinal realities at work here, aren't there? I mean, if we have lost, isn't it time to wave the white flag and come to terms with the winners? If we Christians have come up short in the battle for the culture, what does that say about our claims for the supremacy of Christ, the superiority of our doctrine, and the unsurpassable claim of the gospel? If Christ and his gospel is true, then why does the world look the way that it does? What's going on? Doesn't the whole Christian reality begin to totter and then topple into disaster and defeat, revealed as an empty dream and a sham religion once and for all? What's going on? Of course, this is precisely the point of the parable. And the question we ask today about winners and losers is essentially the same question that was asked by the slaves of the landowner who had planted his field with beautiful wheat only to see it produce an embarrassing crop of weeds. The slaves are stunned at the development. They know the character and the capacity of their master. What he did was always right and was done with great results. The landowner planted good seed, so when the shoots finally pushed out their fruit, the slaves were shocked. Weeds? What in the world are they doing here? They don't belong in this field. It made no sense. How could it be? This is actually our question too, isn't it? If Jesus is the Son of God, if he has conquered death and Satan and broken the power of sin, and we know and confess that these things are true, well then, what's wrong with the world? Why is it still a mess? Why is it jammed with unbelievers and people who revel in sin and who eagerly celebrate the ways of wickedness? Why is the world chock full of people who have no use for God's truth and who seem to think that the only truth they need is what is lurking in their own foolish hearts and their own guts? If Jesus is Lord, why does it look like Satan is running the show? Why is the world full of weeds? That's the driving question of the parable. And Jesus provides the answer. And the answer is simple and obvious. An enemy did this. The weeds aren't God's idea. They are an alien intrusion into an otherwise excellent field. So, all right, now Why don't we take care of it? Why not follow the inclination of the slaves and get rid of the weeds? This is exactly what we would do. You uproot the dandelion, you dig up the thistle, you chop down the ragweed, you wipe out the nettles and the poison ivy. But the landowner doesn't do this. In fact, he refuses to let anyone so much as touch a weed. It's not that he's changed his mind and decided that weeds are all right after all. Hardly. It's not his love or even his tolerance of weeds that drives him to stay the executioner's zeal of the slaves who are ready to go on a weed-clearing mission. No, the landowner stops them not for the sake of the weeds, but for the sake of the wheat. Wheat takes time. It needs to grow. Start ripping up weeds, well, you're liable to take some wheat with it. The landowner won't let that happen. The weeds must be left alone, for now. It turns out then that this parable is the closest thing to an explanation for the problem of evil that you're going to find anywhere in the Bible. It is much less a story about the nature and makeup of the church, which I don't think it is at all, than it is a story of reassurance for believers in the church who begin to wonder about the prevalence of weeds when the Lord is supposed to be in charge of the whole world. The farmer whose field grows more velvet leaf and cockleburs than beans doesn't look like much of a farmer. And the God whose world is filled with wicked people who casually flout his will with carefree abandon doesn't look like much of a God. But he is God, and he is in control of the whole world, even a world overflowing with weeds. That's what Jesus wants his disciples and us to know. No matter how it might look, he's in control. He gives the orders. And his orders are obeyed to the letter. And right now, his orders are clear. Leave the weeds alone. For the sake of the wheat, let the weeds be. And what this means, of course, is that the presence of weeds in the world should shock no follower of Christ. Even if the weeds begin to take over and threaten to overrun the field entirely, Jesus is still in charge. The weeds are there because he allows them to be there. But they won't be there forever. Their end has already been determined. The verdict may be delayed, but it will not be vacated. It will be enforced when Jesus gives the order. Don't be deceived by appearances. Whether it looks like the church is winning or losing is irrelevant. No matter how it looks, Jesus is Lord. He gives the orders. His orders are followed, always. The consummation of his kingdom is coming. According to his plan and according to his timetable, it is coming. Nothing can slow it. Nothing can stop it. Jesus is Lord. And what this means should be rather obvious. It means that you and I can live with unwavering confidence and absolute certainty about the state of things, regardless how things might look or feel. And it means that it is not time for the church to take stock and reassess her message or update her doctrines or tweak the gospel. It means that we don't need to concede or acquiesce to the apparent winners in the culture war. Not ever. Wheat does not come to terms with weeds. We don't binge on a delirious weed eradication project, but neither do we start suing for terms of peace or start calculating ways to salvage what we can in an effort to find ways to coexist with the apparent winners. Jesus is the winner. And the day will come when all will know that truth. The enemy and his crop of weeds will burn. And the Lord's wheat will be gathered into his barns. That's the reality. God's people are not deluded, and they are not losers. They're just God's people, following God's commands and trusting God's promises. That's the message of the parable. Open your ears and hear it. Amen.